Your digital roadmap probably talks about efficiency. What if it also determined who gets a fighting chance to live? Stay with us as we explore the moral calculus of deploying AI in healthcare and the hard lessons every transformation team can apply across industries. My name is Alexander Nevsky, and this is Innovation Tales.
Navigating change, one story at a time, we share insights from leaders tackling the challenges of today's digital world. Welcome to Innovation Tales, the podcast exploring the human side of digital transformation.
You've heard the mantra, move fast and break things. In healthcare, however, the thing you break could be a person. That's why I've invited RJ Kadziora, co-founder of Astenda, HIMSS Davis and Health 2.0 Leadership Award winner, and 25-year digital health veteran, to show how speed and safety can coexist. At Astenda, RJ sets the technical strategy for solutions that truly improve lives. Today, he explains how ambient listening Gen AI scribes cut clinicians' dreaded pajama time, letting them spend more minutes with patients while the notes write themselves. Put simply, his blueprint helps anyone tasked with turning AI's promise into a real-world impact, no matter where it sits on your transformational roadmap. Without further ado, here's my conversation with RJ Kadziora. RJ, welcome to the show.
Alex, thanks for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Thanks for taking the time. You specialize in digital health, but you also describe yourself as an aspiring author. The book you're writing describes your productive harmony framework. So what's the story there? What led you to take on this project?
Yeah, thanks. The book working title is The Productive Harmony Framework, and it comes from my life experience. I am an entrepreneur, and I also race triathlons. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of activity, physical activity that's part of that. And yes, that aspect is challenging, but one of the reasons I've gotten into triathlons is because of the mental challenge as well. And what drives both of those components, as I sat down last summer and started thinking about, okay, I want to write a book. It's been a passion in the back of my mind that I write a lot of white papers and journal articles, presentations, webinars. What is the next step, the evolution and sort of my career and what interests me? I was like, I want to write a book. So as I worked through that, it just, everything kept coming back to the idea of energy, whether it's physical energy or mental energy, to be able to get stuff done and be productive, and even more so, getting it done right the first time. And what's fascinating is I started looking into this. The first thing most people think of, the first thing that I really started thinking of early in my career was time management. Okay, how am I going to manage my time to get stuff done? There's only 24 hours in a day. You can't control time. And so what can you control? You can control yourself, your energy. How do you focus your energy to be able to maximize those time that you do have? You're probably going to sleep 6, 7, 8 hours a night if you're lucky. So that's out the door. You can't use that time when getting work or personal projects done. That sleep time is very productive, though, because it gives you the energy to be able to do all of these different tasks. So that's what drove the idea of the book, Productive Harmony. What was fascinating when I started it and was working with editors, I really thought I had to come up with everything, all of the ideas, all of the content. And that was very intimidating. And it was interesting because they're like, how many words do you want it to be? That meaning has no concept to me as a first-time author, or you or most of the listening audience. I read books, but I don't know. And so we wound up settling on 50,000 words, which was roughly 200 pages. And I learned that, no, the entire concept idea didn't have to come from me. A good book to be engaging has to be loaded with personal stories, research articles, first-person interviews that I've done with different people on the topic. I reached out on different social media platforms and talked to PhD experts in time management, which is fascinating because I didn't even know people were researched from that perspective. So instead of really just a book writing exercise, it became a research exercise for me, which I do every day in my day-to-day life. So it became a much easier task, but very fascinating to dive into the idea of time management and energy. One of the interesting things that I've discovered in this, we as humans, humanity, have been thinking about time since very early on. Cavemen had to think about time. Okay, you only have so many hours, the sun's going to go down, we need to get food, we need to have shelter. In the early 1900s, there was a gentleman, his name was Frederick Taylor, and the science has been called Taylorism now, but he really kicked off that modern day theory of time management, of sitting there and looking at a task and breaking it down into components and using a stopwatch to figure out how to optimize productivity from a time perspective. What history has forgotten and what I uncovered in my research was the idea that after 2 years, his efforts did not increase productivity, but led to burnout and he got fired. Oh. So it's amazingly fascinating to me that what's driving us all day to day is this time management and getting stuff done in that early theories didn't quite pan out as we thought. So I think energy management today in the 21st century is a much more effective way of looking at how to plan out your day and maximize those hours that you do have.
For me, I guess the first things I think of when I hear managing my energy and increasing my productivity is avoiding context switches. I don't know if it's the same for other people, but they are extremely expensive in terms of energy. Changing between one task and a completely different task takes just so long, and I really cannot afford to do that 20 times a day, complete burnout at the end of the day, and this is unsustainable. So I wonder, can you give us a teaser of what energy management means for you in the book?
It is about focusing and looking at how energy affects me day to day. So in my particular case, I do get up early in the morning, 4:30, quarter of five, and train for an hour and a half to 2 hours. That actually, maybe counterintuitively, gives me energy to be able to take on the day. The days that I do rest and relax, there's maybe even some level of anxiety of, oh, am I doing enough? Am I doing training? But I need less coffee, less caffeine those days that I train because it gives me energy. And I know I need to focus on tasks that need a lot of thinking, a lot of focus early in the morning. Through the midday, I focus on administrative types of activities, which don't need as much time and attention kind of thing, but definitely have to get done. And then late afternoon, I get a burst of creativity where I try and focus on more of our marketing activities and what am I going to do next for this book and the next chapter in the book. The creativity really peaks there. So when you do think about energy, think of your day and how does that flow throughout the day. The one thing too, to your point of not doing this context switching, it's horrible for using your energy, for being engaged in a task, staying on target. We all have our smartphones. We all have our cell phones. And yes, you turn off notifications, but for most people, it just sits next to you. And what's fascinating, by putting the phone in another room, made a significant difference of not having it front of mind and not distracting me. It's almost like fear of missing out. Okay, the phone's there, but I'm not touching it. I'm not focused. I'm not getting it's not dinging, not getting the distractions, but it's still there. You just want to pick it up and look at it real quick. So having it in another room made a world of change. And the other thing a lot of people talk about is AI these days. I do have a chapter in the book on the use of AI for productivity. And that's what I think the biggest general use case, as we talk about generative AI these days, is a boon for society in terms of being much more efficient.
Do you see that also as a tool to manage energy? I can imagine that sometimes we might choose, instead of doing a task the old-fashioned way ourselves with our own brain, we might take it easy a little bit and we frame the task, but the AI does the heavy lifting. Is that how you see it?
Yes, absolutely. So I think I do use AI a lot in my everyday world in terms of marketing, product development, data analytics. We're implementing it in various capacities in some of our digital health projects that we're engaged with. And as an example, I had to do user interviews with PhD experts in smell testing. something that was a new area for me as an individual. But I interviewed dozens, if not hundreds of people to figure out what a specific product should be, what should the business rules be, how will the system work? So I can do that. But it typically takes a couple hours to sit down and plan that out. Whereas you use any of the Gen AI systems today, you just ask it, create me a user interview. And then you give it a lot of background and context about what you want to do and what you're trying to accomplish. And it generates 10 questions. And you just, okay, generate me 10 more. Generate me 10 more. Generate me 10. And within minutes, you have 50 questions that you can use to structure a user interview to figure out what makes them tick and how can we help them with an application focused on the idea of smell testing. It's very much an 80% solution. So I still go into those questions. Okay, what is a good flow as part of the conversation to make that work very effectively? But something that would normally take me a couple hours took minutes.
Yeah. And from an energy perspective, having a thinking body, it's obviously the ideal would be to have an actual human to brainstorm through, but that's limited to the most important use cases. And it's nice to have the ability to tap into a thinking body, a research assistant that helps us go through whatever tasks we need to do. But I did want to pick your brain more generally now, since you've branched out into the digital health space, and that's your specialty, of course. I would like to understand, like, what are the use cases that have already seen wide adoption? So on the traditional side of things, I think there's quite already a lot of machine learning algorithms used to augment and complement radiologists or detecting tumors, identifying patterns, of course, with traditional machine learning. And on the Gen AI side of things, I think the first thing that comes to my mind in healthcare is assistants that doctors can use to reduce the amount of paperwork they need to do after the clinical setting. So when you have to go into the office and just write up everything, that instead they can talk to the AI as they're doing the procedure or whatever they're involved in and get most of that documentation done on the fly. First of all, before we move on to other use cases, are those, in your opinion, established already, or is it still quite early?
I'm glad you mentioned machine learning, because I think of that very often as the forgotten AI. It has been around for a while and is making an impact. And the use of it in image analysis is probably the top use case from a machine learning perspective. Because you and I, a trained expert, you know, can look at a breast image, brain image. We do a lot of work in diabetic retinopathy, which is looking at the retina of your back of your eye for detection of diabetic retinopathy. It's the leading cause of preventable blindness. So if you find incidence of it, then you can make a difference in that person's life. And so that's the first use case. Fairly well established from a scientific computing perspective. The FDA here in the US, which is a regulatory body that is to approve these algorithms, these machine learning systems, I think it's close to 900 now over the last decade or so. The vast majority of them, probably 80-85%, are related to like machine learning and imagery. It's a very well used, established use case. They can do better than the practitioners, and they don't get tired. Call back to that idea of energy. If you're looking at 100 images over a couple hours, you're going to get tired. You're human. The computer doesn't. Now, if we look at generative AI, which is the latest craze today, it's barely 2 years old. Ambient listening is the area where it's being most quickly adopted. And it is, to your use case of taking notes and writing those charts, and doctors and nurses talk about pajama time. My daughter happens to be a physical therapist, and she called on her way home from work last night. And she's like, yeah, I need to sit down and write notes for 25 patients that I saw today. I'm like, but now, you know, you're done work. And she's like, no, I got to do these notes now. So she doesn't, unfortunately, she doesn't have the ambient listening technology in place. But the idea is, let the AI system listen to the conversation that you're having in the room and take the notes to make the overall process, the encounter, much more efficient. And what I like about that approach is it lets the doctor, the medical practitioners, get back to why they got into medicine. They got into medicine to talk to people, to help people engage with them, not to type notes on a computer keyboard. You know, a lot of the doctors, you hear stories that they just have their back turned to a patient because they're typing away on their keyboard. That's not why they got into medicine. They want to help that individual. So this opportunity in a non-invasive way allows the patient, medical practitioners to talk to each other, have that engaged conversation, and the AI can pick up and generate those notes. Then from an efficiency perspective, it could also get into medical coding from a billing perspective and help out there. So it is the big use cases in healthcare today are really around the idea of how do we gain efficiency from an administrative back-end perspective.
In some of your posts, you were mentioning digital therapeutics. Is that also an area where the AI is enabling new ways of using it?
Digital therapeutics is an interesting term because it is relatively new. I think of it as a special class of digital health applications or systems where you walk in a drugstore, pharmacy, and buy all sorts of medications, vitamins, things over the counter without a prescription. Think of that as your general digital health application. There's probably 300,000 of those out there, depending on how you count. Mm-hmm. A digital therapeutic takes that to the next level. It's a comparison to an actual drug or medication that went through extensive clinical trials and clinical regulatory approval here in the US would be the FDA. So it's an elevated system. It has that evidence and it's prescribed, just like a medication would be to a patient, it is prescribed to a patient to improve them. Mental health is a huge area for this. Some new migraine systems were just developed. So instead of taking a drug, which has lots of side effects, you know, I'm sure you've seen those commercials on TV, hear them, where it's just like, who would ever take this drug? For 5 minutes, they've gone off on all the potential side effects. Digital health app doesn't have those same issues kind of thing. You're not taking a physical drug at that point, and they can make a difference. And that's the idea of a digital therapeutic. Unfortunately, it's a little challenged right now from a reimbursement perspective here in the U.S. January 1, just a couple months ago, there were some new approvals and methods to get them to be paid for. So the idea is the doctor prescribes them like a drug to the patient, but the insurance company is covering them. So the company creating the digital therapeutic can get a higher reimbursement rate. The EU has done a lot better with this, I think. It's still in its early stages, but they've tied that regulatory approval to reimbursement pathways. Here in the US, it was like, oh, you're approved. Now, how do you get paid for it? In Europe, they tied those things together, which is a much better approach.
I saw some startups in the healthcare AI space offering, through Gen AI, automated checkups that somebody who has been prescribed a certain medication takes the right dosage, the right schedule, and generally something that I guess nurses would do, but nurses can only visit so many patients in one day or call so many patients in one day. And that enables to augment their work, if I understand correctly, to help patients follow through with the treatment that have been prescribed in an outpatient environment, if they're at home or something. And so is that the next level from that, the digital therapeutics, where it's not just helping with like prescriptions for chemical drugs, but also encouraging people to do specific behaviors that then create better health outcomes?
Yes, that's the amazing aspect of what this Gen AI is going to make capable. In a lot of cases, it's capable today. You do have to be cautious. There's notes of caution around using the generic AIs out there, the ChatGPTs, the Claude kind of thing, because they are not designed for clinical medical use. They are very capable, and they will give you answers that sound really good, but you do have to be aware of biases and the idea of hallucinations that the AI might make something up. It ultimately, it wants to please you. You know, it's not going to sit there and tell you, I don't know the answer. Like you or I having a conversation, I can be like, oh, I don't know. It's going to make something up. And it sounds convincing, which is challenging. But from a mental health capacity, there is a mental health crisis globally. There are not enough professionals to help all those people. So yes, how can we implement these AI systems to help those people to have those conversations, to be the companion? Your use case that you were talking about is patient follow-up. Are they taking the medication? Are they having complications? The AI systems today are very capable of having that conversation with an individual, getting that feedback, and then analyzing that feedback, not just from a content perspective, but also from a tone and an emotional perspective, which is just another level you or I, if you really know that patient over time, could develop that type of awareness. Is this person sad? Are they angry? And it usually takes a little bit more experience to develop that. But the AI systems can tag a conversation as this patient is showing signs of depression, which then maybe you have a human follow up with them. But the computer doesn't get tired, can have conversations all throughout the day. You know, a nurse that's doing follow-up on dozens of patients might have to constrain those calls to 3 or 5 minutes to get through all of those, where the AI doesn't have that constraint. So you think of your mother who might be elderly at home or an assisted living facility. It's a great opportunity to engage with them and have a conversation. And so how do you use that AI to even go beyond that? Hey, have you taken your medications today? Hey, how are you feeling today? To engage in a much more meaningful conversation.
It does raise so many questions about the nature of care, just generally, ethically speaking. How do we feel if a close one of our family members, instead of getting the visits of a nurse that they should be, that they used to get, now an AI is calling them? But at the same time, I think what you were saying was more describing augmentation rather than replacement. And earlier you were talking about ambient listening, and I believe it was in Fei-Fei's Lee book where she was also talking about this technology as like a few years back when it was just the beginning, and how some of the medical professionals were quite concerned about this being used as a system to monitor performance or something like that, and also raises quite a few ethical questions. And you're the expert that deals with people adopting this technology day in, day out. How do you think about those ethical questions?
You definitely have to address them. You definitely have to be aware of them. And there is a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt when it comes to these AI systems today. So you do have to think along those ethical guidelines of how are we going to be using this system? What do we have to consider? What are the risks to patient care and wellness? AI generally stands for artificial intelligence, but you mentioned it a minute ago. I really think of it as augmented intelligence. How do we use it to make our systems and processes better than they are today? And that's a fascinating possibility. So I don't want it to replace the nurse. If someone's in an assisted living facility, that human contact is very important. But it's fascinating because when the AI systems are compared against human interactions, time and time again, they come back as the AI is more empathetic in that conversation, in that note that was sent via email or text message. A lot of that, I think, is just we're human. We're tired at the end of the day and only have so much capacity, energy to apply to every one of these conversations. So it is an opportunity to improve that relationship. I still want the nurse checking on my mother and having that human interaction. But at some point, it's going to be irresponsible to not take advantage of these tools and these technologies, because they can do it, they can make a difference. So yes, cautionary notes, we need to be aware of the risks, the biases that are inherent in these technologies. And the bias is there because it learned on information that we as humans created. We as humans are biased. It's much easier to talk to an AI and help identify its biases than you and I. We're generally not aware of our biases. That self-reflection, introspection is difficult, it's challenging. And do you do it in every moment of the day as you're providing care and treatment? You have the best of intentions to do the best job you can for every patient you see as a healthcare professional. But your history situations are going to impact that, and that can be tuned out of the AI systems, as well as the other thing, obviously, mistakes. We call them hallucinations these days, but it's basically an AI system making something up. But doctors, humans, we are not perfect. There's a reason for second opinions. And you talk to a colleague. You can also talk to the AI systems to get an informed opinion, which interestingly can be aware of the vast volumes of research that are generated each day, each year. You and I can't keep up with that.
It's getting us to ask very unexpected questions about our own cognitive capabilities. You mentioned our emotional intelligence, our ability to read other people's emotions, empathize. We thought, I guess, a few years back that this was purely human. No way that artificial intelligence can get there. It does raise a number of questions about where do we stand in there. But maybe that's a conversation for another day. I really wanted to get your perspective on the future of healthcare. You're involved in many projects using machine learning or artificial intelligence or other technologies, but where do you see the field a few years from now, let's say 5 years?
I think there's amazing potential that we're not even aware of what's going to happen. My favorite quote these days is from Bill Gates, that we as humans tend to overestimate what's possible in 2 years and underestimate what's possible in 10. We have no idea where this technology is going to be capable of in 10 years. There's a lot of fear of it replacing. I still think it's augmenting. And we still very much want that human touch, even if the AI has empathy. We do want to keep that human touch in it. It's going to change it for the better. It is going to make a difference in the health and wellness of people globally. There are aspects of technical equity and can everybody get access to these systems? Challenges, yes, we have to work on, but it is going to make a difference in the lives of millions of people.
And as we're about to wrap up, I usually ask a couple of questions at the end. So the first one is, what is a book, tool, or habit that has made the most impact on you in the last 12 months?
AI is right up there. I can't overemphasize the idea of how much of an impact AI has made. But one of the books, interestingly, I keep coming back to and I'm starting to refer people to, obviously I'm writing my own book, but I discovered a book called When from an author, Dan Pink, a really good book. And we all think about why we do stuff or what do we have to do, but his book does a deep dive into when does it make sense to do something, whether it's what point, like seasonally, what time of the year or what time of day. And that's what tied into my energy thinking. It's like he was talking about when do you do a task? And it's okay, I'm basing that decision on my energy.
Wonderful. We'll make sure to provide the link in the description next to, of course, your project. And the final question, mirroring what you were saying just a moment ago, we've discussed a lot of things that are changing, but do you see maybe one thing that is going to remain the same 10 years from now?
What is not going to change? I think AI is going to change so much. I don't know that we recognize the world a few years from now, honestly. I think of AI as like the printing press, electricity, computing technology, the internet, smartphones, social media. These changes change society significantly.
Absolutely. Super exciting for some of us. Maybe super scary for some others in our audience. But in any case, RJ, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Alex.
The core points of today's conversation are simple. Use AI to give time back to people, such as with ambient listening digital scribes that capture clinical notes during the visit, so doctors aren't at play doing pajama time paperwork. And not deploying AI tools that clearly help patients and expand access to healthcare maybe is irresponsible as failing to address bias or safety issues. If you'd like to see the projects behind these lessons, check out the case studies RJ shares at estenda.com. As always, we have more exciting topics and guest appearances lined up, so stay tuned for more tales of innovation that inspire, challenge, and transform. Until next time, peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Innovation Tales. Get inspired, connect with other practitioners, and approach the digital revolution with confidence. Visit innovation-tales.com for more episodes. See you next time.